Hello again and welcome to another episode of Voices from SA. My name is Nicholas Claude. I hope you're keeping well wherever you are. Thanks for joining me today. My guest this week is the community activist. He's a qualified social worker. His name is John Clark. We met through Kevin Bloom, actually, who I had on the podcast recently. Kevin has been writing about Kolobani land issue down in the Eastern Cape, and John has been intimately involved in this dispute, supporting the Amadiba Crisis Committee in their struggle. He's been going back and forth for well nigh on 20 years now. So in our discussion, John explains how he became involved in this dispute that the Kolobani community are in with the Australian Mining Concern, MRC, and seemingly elements of the state, involved in an ongoing legal battle, a struggle for their land and for their way of life that has cost the lives up until now of a number of activists. We also chat a little bit about John's path from observer to activist and discuss a little the spiritual and philosophical components of his activism and some of his hopes for, obviously, a resolution to the dispute. And we managed to include some discussion on land rights, traditional leadership, and state capture, I suppose, in the context of Kolobani. So please now enjoy my chat with John. John, thanks for your time today. It's good to be in touch with you. It's quite a weird sort of, I'm not sure what the term, I was trying to think of what the term is, synergy, but, you know, I spoke to Kevin Bloom just a couple of weeks back, and he suggested that I talk to you about Kolobani in particular. And then just earlier this week, well, yesterday, in fact, wasn't it not? Now we're on the 2nd of July. Sam Soul, who I've also recently had on this podcast, also had published. I mean, Kevin's been writing about Kolobani for some time, and now Sam is also running with that story. And so now you're the third in a row of people who are going to come and talk to me about. Well, I hope we'll have a chance to talk about some of the issues that this struggle in Kolobani raised, particularly about sort of the government and ownership of resources and the sort of quite strong focus it seems that the government is still placing on extractive sort of industries in this country, land ownership, traditional authority, things like that as well, which have also been very contentious in a number of different parts of the country for not, well, traditional authorities have been manipulated by governments in this country for, I would say, more than 100 years. I don't know, you said that maybe I should start by giving my assessment of Kolobani, and I'm reluctant to get into too much detail because it is quite a complicated story, but I suppose if I break it down, it's the struggle between a community on the coast of the Eastern Cape, south of Port Edward, and it's a struggle of this community against a mining company, an Australian mining entity called MRC. Well, there's Transworld Energy and Minerals. Is MRC part of that, as I understand it? And there's titanium in the dunes on the coast of this particular area that somehow seems to cover between 900 and 3,000 hectares. You can perhaps guide me on that. And it's titanium in particular that this mining company is after. And this has been going on for, well, you said 17 years, so a long time. I mean, I've seen a copy of an affidavit that you submitted, was it to the public protector in 2011 already, so that's already 8 years ago. Essentially, the community has come together to say that they do not want the mind because they will be A, displaced and lose their whole connection to their ancestral lands, but also that the mine itself will do incredible damage to the natural environment, whoever's living there or not. Recently, the North Gauteng High Court, that was at the beginning of this year, came with a judgment that, well, it's a bit of a, we can go into that. It says one of the key sort of sentences or moments, I think, was that a survey needs to be taken of the community to ensure that a full and informed consent is given to whatever decision is made, either to mine or not to mine. And that is how I understand the situation to be right now. I suppose on top of this, we should say that the new Minerals and Energy Resources Minister, Gwede Mantashe, he has seemed to have thrown himself quite steadfastly headlong into this matter. He was down the coast for a meeting that ended in chaos in January this year, as I understand it. So, I mean, how is that for a summary?
It's great. It's helpful. Just some small kind of corrections. The judgment was in November last year.
Okay.
But the Minister Mantashe has sought leave to appeal, and so it's destined to drag a little bit further on. But
what was the significance of that? Because it seems to be, it could be, I suppose, if the community is confident that any survey taken will be in its favor, because I understand 68 of 74 families that live in, is it families or,
or homesteads?
Homesteads, yeah. That live in the affected area do support the Amadiba Crisis Committee, which is the sort of committee that's fighting for the rights of the people on the land. So I suppose they would have that confidence that any survey is going to find in their favor. But of course, there's also suspicions that this survey could be manipulated. And there were some concerns, I think, at the meeting that the Minister Mantashe attended in January, that there were some people who were talking for the Amadiba Crisis Committee who were not actually members of the Crisis Committee. So there's a concern, I suppose, of some manipulation. And we'll,
I think maybe just to say, you know, thank you so much, Nick, for this opportunity, because and the people that you mentioned, Kevin Bloom, Sam Sol, the word is actually serendipity or synchronicity. I'm not quite sure the difference between them, but a serendipitous synchronicity that, you know, of all these voices coming together. And that has really been, in some ways, what's kept me going. I mean, I was listening to your interview with Ronnie Casseroles on your podcast, and he talked about, as a good Marxist that he is, that there needs to be at some level an article of faith that keeps you going. And Ronnie and I, you know, have become friends, and I just love his sort of deep critical analysis of things. But it does come down eventually to the will and the desire and the kind of the passion. And my sense is that, you know, the intellectual and legal, specifically legal kind of appraisal of the situation inevitably ends up leaving a large part of the narrative out, because it doesn't quite fit the nice binary sort of dualistic way in which the law likes to frame things. You know, you have a winner and a loser, and it's this or that, and it's, you know, likewise, economists are also, you know, prone to kind of, and politicians certainly. I mean, in our representative democracy, you know, you vote for one party means you can't also vote for another. You've got to make a binary choice. So the deeper relevance of the Nkolabeni Amadiba struggle has to be understood from experiential type of engagement rather than kind of abstract intellectual analysis. So my first thing to say to people, look, folk, come down to the Wild Coast and experience it for yourself. because that's really what got me kind of into this whole thing right at the word go. And the summarized version is that in 2001, I was, as a social worker already, I'd had about a 20-year career working in development and the RDP and trying to promote the vision of a people-driven development process and all the wonderful things that the Reconstruction Development Program Manifesto, you know, articulated, which was what brought the ANC to power in 1994 and then became the basic framework for the government of national unity. So I was in that headspace in 1994, having already served.
The euphoria of the post
of that, and then saying, well, this is wonderful. Now we've achieved political liberation. Now we can seek to bring about economic transformation. And it's going to be about people being the protagonists of their own development. And I was disillusioned by 2002 because it wasn't happening. We had gone into reverse gear, if I can use that kind of metaphor, by the growth, you know, employment and redistribution strategy. I still have that memory of Al Zapira's cartoon with Al Thabo Mbeki, Mr. Delivery, having to deliver. Hmm. And unfortunately, this notion that somehow development is something you deliver. You can deliver goods or services, but development is something which happens inside people as a consequence of what happens between people and their natural environment. So when I went as a tourist with my family, being invited to the Amadiba Adventure, I felt like I'd stumbled into paradise, because here was a rural community, historically disadvantaged, marginalized, who had taken initiative to basically become the protagonists of their own development in order to begin to kind of like determine their own developmental path. And I just couldn't, you know, kind of shut up about it. I told all my friends, and then I had a 3-year stint working for the World Health Organization and the UN, and the UN system in Africa and humanitarian work as a social worker. And I would tell all my colleagues, look, folk, if you want a bit of R&R, go down to the Wild Coast. There's this horse trail. You'll just experience a re-enchantment with the world, a belief.
A reconnection with nature.
A connection with nature. And for me, from a spiritual level too, a kind of a coming home from a sort of a cognitive exile, or in what I call a sort of a state of a mental exile, where we are divorced from the planet. You know, the nature of the exile is you love home, but you're not there. It was like coming home. And where we came to understand that we do not live on the world, the planet. We live in it. We live in its ecosystems. We live within a harmony. If we're going to see a developmental process that's sustainable, to use that dreadful word, which has unfortunately become so corrupted, if we're going to live a developmental process that satisfies human needs and the quality of life, you've got to live in the planet and realize you live in the earth, not on it. That you've got to be participants in the process. We are not a collection of objects. We're a community of subjects or intersubjective beings. So that was what the Amadiba Adventures was. Now, I'm painting a picture which people say, this sounds like too good to be true. Mm. It sounds so romantic.
Some sort of hippie fantasy.
But it was happening. The EU was funding it. There was it won awards. It was like this wonderful thing. And for me, as a strong environmentalist, as somebody who's a social worker as well, who very concerned about human poverty and human need. Here was a situation where people that were already coherent with their natural environment were able to basically kind of invite people, earn good money from tourists, and to celebrate this wonderful environment. So it was a wonderful re-enchantment experience. So with that background, now you understand why, when I heard that there was a mining rights application to mine those coastal dunes, well, when people ask me to try and summarize a story, I say, have you seen the film Blood Diamond? And they say, well, if they've said yes, I said, well, this is kind of like the same story. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a huge irony about that, because the film Blood Diamond was actually partially filmed on the Wild Coast in amongst the Amadiba. Mm-hmm. They used that venue dressed up and looking like Kono and Sierra Leone. And then the next question, I said, well, if you haven't seen that one, have you seen the film Avatar? Well, that's also what happened, because this is about people living a coherence with their natural environment. If you know the Avatar script, it's about the, you know, them, the, you know, the, these Earthlings from planet Earth that desperately need this, what do they call it? Unobtainian, I think it got called, this rare mineral that was gravity-defying, which would kind of feed their addictive kind of, you know, sort of addiction to extractive industries. And you've got these people living in this, in coherence with it. So that story is, and they try and depose, you know, undermine the local, you know, kind of indigenous knowledge and indigenous people
structures,
and you know, well, anyway, the story plays out. So that's a quick way of trying to summarize the gestalt of what the story's about. And so, and I never expected, you know, given our constitution, given our, you know, what you know, what the ANC stood for in coming to power, that I would find myself having to be growingly in the same adversarial oppositional relationship with ANC ministers that I was under apartheid with National Party ministers. And I've had run-ins with, I was reflecting on Pik Botha's recent death. You know, I had a run-in with him at one time as well, when at some political rally where I just had to challenge him that. So I'm basically saying, well, how can this Amadiba narrative become understood as an emblematic story for what we as South Africans need to rediscover about ourselves and our values and what it means to be a liberated country from the past. And as it's also now grown with tragically the assassination of my friend Bazuka Khadebe, it's become an international emblematic narrative. And it wasn't me that said it, but I suspected it was Kevin Bloom said, this is the standing rock story of the South.
Yeah, he did mention that in the discussion.
So that, I don't know if that helps, just to give people the context.
Yeah.
And I'm thank you for the chance for me to kind of like unburden myself and, as we say in social work, to ventilate. Because I'm, there's this part of me which says this is outrageous, that this should have been
good. I'm here to listen and learn. I suppose one thing I did, I was thinking as you were talking, that one thing I did fail to mention in my short sort of, as I summarize it in my own head at the beginning introduction, was that people have died. Bazuka Radebe was one of a couple of people that have been, well, he was certainly, it seems, assassinated, and one or two people have died mysterious deaths. I mean, is that a community now living in fear, and do you fear that the state is not able to protect that community?
Well, let me say that, I know Kevin talks about 12 people that have died. I can say without fear of contradiction that I know that 4 people have been killed because of their opposition to mining. Briefly, they are, in 2003, before I got involved, Mandoda Indovela, who was a headman, who when they were beginning the prospecting operations had warned us, you know, in the traditional council at the Ungungundlovu Kumkulu, where they meet, that, hang on, this is the thin edge of the wedge. We can't just let this, regard this prospecting as a kind of, you know, sort of a research exercise. Kind of, yeah. This is the beginning of mining. He was shot and killed soon thereafter, never solved. The next person to die was after I got involved, and I got quite intimately involved because from my years from 2006, 2007, and in 2008, Scorpion Damane, who was not anti the idea of mining, but when he became aware of the kind of the, you know, the corrupt deal that was being, being, you know, kind of, allegedly corrupt deal. That Mark Caruso and the minister, the director general of mineral resources, Sandile Nonkina, had brokered, where they had this BEE partner called Zolco, or the Korobeni Empowerment Company. Scorpion said, look, I can't be part of this. And I've got video footage of how he spoke out boldly against this. And that was in June of 2007. 6 months later, he had died. I visited the widow, The family offered my condolences. She asked me to please assist her to try and get insurance payouts for her husband. Me being a social worker, I then contracted with her, and we were able to solve, you know, get that sorted. And that gave me access to his medical file with his local GP. And I can say, on the balance of probabilities, now I'm not in a court of law, can't say beyond reasonable doubt, but on the balance of probabilities, it was quite clear to me that Scorpion Damani had been poisoned. And at the same time, Bazooka with Khadebe had also been targeted. And I have a conversation with Bazooka and a cameraman after Scorpion died, in which he talks about how Scorpion told him, look, you must stand strong, friend, because you are the strong one of us. As long as you're alive, they are not going to be able to mine these dunes. And so that was almost like Bazooka's said those were the last words that Scorpion had spoken to him. And then the tragedy of in 2016, Bazooka gets shot and killed. Now, no question that this was an assassin, that this was a murder. You know, there was still some doubt people created. Was Scorpion, did he die of natural causes? Well, I'm convinced. So those, a year before Bazooka died, was killed, there was Balasheleni Mtwa, who is one of the elders as well, a man who's buried right there in the dunes, close to where the dunes are, in his homestead, is the one that were one of the first that would have to be relocated. And he died just before they were to commence the new mining rights application, public participation process. We had to rush him to hospital, and he died. Now, I'm still waiting for the police forensic report. That was 2015, 2019, 4 years. So you ask the question, is the state is failing in its duty? Most certainly they are. And this is why I just find it extraordinarily arrogant of Minister Montashe going around as if this is somebody else's problem. Oh, the Minister Kahele, that's him, talk to him. I've met with Mr. Montashe. I've tried to engage with him because of my deep experiences here and say, Minister, you can't fragment and compartmentalize a problem. You know, I think you're solving it by fragmenting it. We have to look at this thing holistically. I mean, he wonders why he gets the gears when he goes down there for his visits. Well, in 2008, after the mining rights had originally, the first application stalled very badly, and the full story of that will still be told, thanks to Sam now being able to at least get it back on the agenda. But in 2008, the minister, Bulyelwa Sonjika, who was then Minister of Minerals, was called back down, and she realized that this was not working. She revoked the mining, suspended the mining rights, and then revoked them. Now, during her visit in 2008, she went to the Xolobeni Junior Secondary School, which had become part of the fiefdom of the mining company because they had been funding it. They'd built put a borehole down. They had helped fund the teacher's salary. So if you can understand, the school principal, these were, you know, his benefactors. He was not happy to see the mining rights revoked. He knew that he couldn't exercise corporal punishment, and he was now complaining that his scholars were being unruly and misbehaving and weren't obeying authority. The truth of the matter is these are the children of the people that are going to be displaced. And they knew darn well that their parents were opposed to the mining and that they were opposed to the mining, and they would use the school solar panel to recharge cell phones, and the cell phones was very important means of keeping in touch with each other through SMSs. This was before the smartphone era, even then. And they were able to then mobilize the community against them. Now, my belief is, and I submitted a detailed report to cabinet ministers, including Naledi Pandor, who was at that time the Minister of Education, in which we found that the school principal had called in the local police and had the entire school body shamboked. The kids were lined up, the boys separated from the girls, and three policemen came and shamboked the entire school body. So Those children who were 16, 15-year-old are now 25, 26. They haven't forgotten about what happened there. They could see that there was brutality there. And a journalist friend of mine, when he saw this, and he said, this is using state resources as a way of trying to intimidate a community. He said, this is wrong, John. This is like reminiscent of 1976 Soweto uprising, where the children are having to take to the streets. So now you can begin to see why I've kind of got myself hooked into this whole thing as a social worker. Lastly, just to say before we carry on, I need to just make this point. Social workers are there to work themselves out of a job. We should do that, and I'm never short of work if you do that. We are there to promote the agency of clients. And all I've really done is follow my social work code of practice to introduce the community to journalists, to writers, to TV crews, all the rest, who have then been able to help them actualize their rights in the Constitution. I see you've got a copy of the Constitution here on your desk. Well, I've got one in my bag, and I just say, well, this is what I'm doing, helping actualize a Bill of Rights. So when we have people empowered and able to articulate their rights for themselves and make claims and demands on government ministers who, by the way, swear an oath of office to uphold that Constitution, well, I thought my job was done. Only to then find that there's this intimidation, this murder, this harassment, and this assassination. So I've had to, unfortunately, stick my head above the parapet to be able to say, look, for goodness sake, this is unusual and exceptional circumstances. Social workers ought not to become the story. I'm going to start speaking out about what's happening here, because it is a travesty. It's an offense against everything what the liberation struggle stands for. And as a consequence of that, Mark Caruso is obligingly now suing me for defamation for statements that I've made. Statements which are in the public interest, statements which are true or substantially true, and basically which have harmed his reputation, but he is now thinking that this is his way of trying to shut me up. And I've appealed to Gweta Montashe. I said, for goodness sake, why don't you just get rid of this mining company? This is their track record. And let's have an open, honest, participatory discussion, as we supposed to have done, under the RDP sort of ethos, to decide whether, in fact, there is a place for mining. And he has shown an uncommon bias towards MRC, as has Sandile Lenontlhina, the former director general who awarded those mining rights, without declaring his conflict of interest. We now know, thanks to Sam's story, has shown that he admitted was going to retire and go down there and was hoping to see, that this would be beneficial to people. A clear conflict of interest. I mean, it's astounding. And he's now trying to tell us that, no, even though he's a special advisor to Minister Montashe, he's not conflicted. Well, the people have a memory. They can see that he's there. They saw him there in 2008. They don't forget so easily. They keep their knowledge alive by an oral tradition. That's how they've always done. And they've done that all the way back to the Ponda Uprising, if we can see, in 1960, which actually started right there at Kolobeni, as I've now found in my research. Anyway, let me take a slick of tea here and catch my breath.
I wanted to just maybe talk a little bit about how you became a social worker in the first place, because I have to say I think you're the first male social worker that I've ever certainly met or even heard about. It seems to have been very much a domain of women. And I mean, that's just a perception that I have of that that profession. So you must have been, when you started it in your career, which would have been, I presume, sometime in maybe the 50s or the 60s?
I look that old. Well, it was 1976 was my first year at university.
All right.
And that obviously was the year the Soweto riots happened. But prior to that, just to say, I'd spent a year in the army. I had grown up in Dundee. I am a, shall we say, as the former CEO of San
Dundee,
Oli,
sort of Northern
KwaZulu-Natal.
Northern KwaZulu-Natal.
My father was a quantity surveyor.
Mining country as well, funnily
mining
enough.
Country. So I am a beneficiary of the unearned dividend of apartheid, to use Nasser Ali's favorite way of describing us privileged whites. And I accept that. I was a beneficiary of the fact that coal mining was what my father was able to make, you know, a living from, in as much as not directly going underground, but as a professional quantity surveyor, because that's, you know, Iscor was, you know, built there, and the, sure, and the coal mines. So I used to go around, you know, all these
Newcastle,
mines.
Newcastle, Frey, Dundee, full of mines.
Exactly, full of mines. So I would not have got my education, I would not have got where I am today, if it were not for the fact that I am the son of a quantity surveyor who benefited from mining. But my father was also a very devoutly committed Catholic, and I wouldn't say I'm quite the same, you know, but he was very concerned about the poor and the downtrodden, and, you know, very active in trying to address, in a charitable kind of way, those who were vulnerable and disadvantaged. So I guess I'm a product of him. Mm. When I went to university, I started doing quantity surveying, because I'd followed my father's profession, but I very soon realized that the world society wasn't needing more quantity surveyors, it was needing something else. 1976 was a big year, both for the fact that that's when the Soweto riots happened, but it was also the year that my conference of the National Catholic Federation of Students was held in Modderpoort in the Free State. And virtually around about this time in July, I remember being freezing cold. And the two people that had a major influence on shaping my consciousness were Albert Nolan, a Dominican priest whose book Jesus Before Christianity was making huge waves at the time. And the other one was Beyers Naudé. Hmm. Now, I'd grown up as a Roman Catholic, and the Dutch Reformed were like, you know, they were sort of, you know, they were never the twain shall meet. You know, and from the Dutch Reformed perspective, us Roman Catholics were known as the Roomse Gevaar. You know, there was a Swart Gevaar, you know, the Rooi Gevaar, and here's the Roomse Gevaar, the Roman danger, because it was high.
There was a theological clash.
Yeah, and also, you know, and of course, Beyers Naudé, and he was a man who had been grown up in the bosom of the Afrikaans Dutch Reformed Church, who had now, for what he is, and I was very inspired by him, and I remember thinking, Don, I'm going to join the Christian Institute, and I remember riding my motorcycle.
That was his organization.
The organization he founded, and I arrived to the offices in Greyville and to kind of sign the forms and join and get involved, and the following day they were banned. So that was the end of the Christian Institute. But I mentioned that because that whole experience, then also, and the other major influence on me was Archbishop Dennis Hurley.
Right.
Now, he was an extraordinary man. I mean, far ahead of his time. And he, while I was at...
And he was a Catholic...
Catholic priest.
Yeah.
And a Catholic bishop.
He became bishop.
And not only in the kind of the political scene, but in the Catholic Church, he was involved in the Second Vatican Council as a whole process of liberating the
church.
There
was that liberation theology sort of emerging from the Catholic Church at that time, particularly in Latin America, but it must have rubbed off a little bit then here.
It did. Well, that's where Albert Nolan's, you know, he was very much part of the whole liberation theology movement, and his book has become, you know, one of the standard texts. Albert and I are still close friends, and it's lovely to still be in touch with him. So it's been a 40-year journey, and you think about it. But the important thing to say about, you know, my experience in that crucible is that Archbishop Hurley had said, look, the time had come for young white men to start seriously questioning whether they should put on a uniform and serve in the SADF as a matter of conscience. And that then led to me eventually becoming a conscience objector. And
you must have been one of the early conscientious objectors then, because it wasn't really popular, was it?
It wasn't, and in fact not the earliest. And I have to pay a huge debt of gratitude to people like Peter Moll, Richard Steele, Charles Yates, you know, a number of them who actually went to prison for their inconscience, the refuse to wear a uniform. And as a result of that, and let's not underestimate it, and there's probably a space for a whole podcast around the whole role of the End Conscription Campaign, conscience objection, all the rest in terms of the whole transformation. But I just, for present purposes, just want to say that if you want to understand what kind of motivates me in the Wild Coast saga, it's because of that hard wiring of my sort of, I suppose, ethical convictions about peace and justice and integrity of creation. So that's really my university days. And when I then found myself faced with the situation on the Wild Coast, you know, that 30 years later, I thought, well, you know, well, I see the same pattern. It's the same critical analysis that Albert Nolan helped me to see about unmasking the powers, engaging the powers, you know, confronting the powers. So that's really all I've done, is I've just tried to be consistent.
Because, I mean, I've read somewhere, I'm not quite sure now, I mean, you've been sort of accused of being the meddling white man, taking advantage of or telling the natives what's good for them to their detriment kind of thing.
I mean, the funny thing was, is that, you know, somehow if you're a white South African born and bred and grown up here, you're a colonialist. But if a white Australian comes with that narrative of telling the community what's good for them, oh, well, he's a kind of an investor. I mean, it's ridiculous, really. If you look at, I've got a recording of Mark Caruso and I having, and Mark Caruso being the CEO from the mining company from Perth, who actually first apparently got involved here in 1996, was his first visit. And I talk about it in my book about how he went there. And he was basically a Perth entrepreneur who was looking to, you know, opportunities to use venture capital in market to actually raise capital that they wouldn't otherwise get through banking for speculative mining operations. And that's how he came involved. And and being a social worker, you know, we build relationships. And I built a relationship with him, and I tried to warn him. I said, Mark, you're playing with fire. You don't understand what's happening. He's the one that actually presents himself as the savior of Africa. And it's extraordinary, you know, how, you know, he believes quite passionately that this mine is going to help this community. All I've done is to simply help the community question the narratives and the agendas and the power. I don't see myself so much as speaking truth to power, although, yes, I do that. But I'm more concerned about speaking the truth about power and about how power corrupts, how absolute power corrupts absolutely. I mean, as Lord Acton famously said. But then also to understand why is it so that when people acquire power, they begin to start losing almost like a sense of rationality and connection, and they kind of find themselves basically oversimplifying into a very crude thing. It's now been, you know, quite well established from neuropsychology that it's known as the dopamine effect. The dopamine starts getting stimulated by the acquisition.
Like a sort of a rush.
You get a rush, and you get too high on your own juice, and it affects your ability to see reality. And, you know, in my book, one of the targets of that book is I try and write about Nasir Ali and SANRAL and the whole crisis of the N2 Wild Coast Toll Road and the e-toll story, and to show that here is a man who spent far too long as the CEO of this who started off very well and you know, on a good wicket and was doing good stuff, but then became, you know, as they say, too high in his own juice.
High on his own supply.
That's right. And in fact, the whole point about, you know, even cocaine addiction, it's because it's not so much the cocaine, it's the cocaine stimulates dopamine. You know, that's why people get addicted. So it's this endogenous addictive process. I'm quite interested in that. And I do that, if I may just say this, not to stigmatize or attack or be personal to people. Social workers do not sit in judgment. We try and understand why people behave in a certain way. We're there in court, you know, if we go to court and then people get sentenced, well, what mitigates this thing? It's power does that. And that's why we have a democracy. We have checks and balances. That's why we need to have a free press. That's why we need to have internal processes within political parties. Not going to help to have an integrity commission, you know, to kind of decide after the fact who are the good or bad people. You've got to have processes inside in your political party to make sure that
you don't need an integrity commission, I suppose, anyway.
Also, because politics tends to attract people who are not psychologically or temperamentally well-suited for politics. I mean,
is that a global problem?
It is, actually. It is. I mean, look, how did Donald Trump get elected? I mean, you know, we could start reflecting.
Well, I don't want to get too distracted. One thing I do want to touch on is there just seems to be at a sort of, at the level of law in this country, two laws colliding. The Mineral and Petroleum Resources Development Act of 2002 and the Interim Protection of Informal Land
Rights
Act. I don't have a year on that. So the MPRDA and the IPILRA. How do they meet and what are the sort of what issues or problems do those two acts raise?
Well, the issue is that, you know, IPILRA was enacted because when the Constitution was enacted, they have Section 25, which actually is property rights. And then there was a kind of a realization that, hang on, you know, there are people with informal land rights who lived in the former homelands areas who are under communal kind of land tenure systems, and they needed to make sure that their land rights were protected. So they had this interim protection whereby the minister would basically hold the land rights of all people living in the previously homeland areas in trust on their behalf. And that the only way in which there could be a deprivation of those rights was if they gave their collective consent. And we use this global benchmark of free, prior, and informed consent. So that's basically what the case was that Richard Spoor attorneys and Tembeke and Gqwebe argued, that land rights in this instance must trump mining rights. And what's making it so interesting is that and so vexed is that sounds well, fine and good. Yes, that makes sense. And the intention is why it was called interim is that that there would be a legislative process that would actually kind of concretize this. And that's, you know, and we still, land issues are still to this day are, a vexed question. But what we have done is we've managed to at least get that one key article in the Freedom Charter, namely that the minerals shall belong to all, and they're as entrenched in the MPRDA. It now puts custodianship of mineral wealth in the hands of the state for the common good. But now let's reflect on that, Nick, because we've just now still trying to throw off the grave clothes of state capture. In a country whereby mineral rights have been nationalized or put into state custodianship, how do you get hold of those minerals? You just need to capture the state. And that's exactly what the Guptas have done. They sought to basically capture the Department of Mineral Resources through Moses Benzeswani, capture this, and in that way they get the mineral rights. And now we see this dreadful, horrific situation with Optimum Colliery, and I have a client who worked there, I've been seen there, I was just there last week again, flying over the area with Richard Spoor to take footage, because we're seeing the most despicable, a cure far worse than the disease. You know, because of the state now not serving the common good. And a key part in the former homeland areas is that they need to get and capture the traditional leadership system too. So now we can open up a whole new kind of dimension to this thing is that what is state capture? It's a particularly odious form of corruption whereby key institutions of state, it's not just bribing an official to kind of do something for you. It's actually capturing the deregulatory process. And that's why, for me, I believe we're never going to unravel the state capture regime until we broaden our focus from just what the Guptas did.
Oh, totally.
And look at how the institution of traditional leadership, which could have been such an important part of the checks and balances in a democracy, has now become basically eviscerated by a capture process, whereby which is almost just as bad as what we saw under colonialism and apartheid, where the traditional leaders were basically used as lackeys for the power interests of the elite. in contradiction with what their customary law would have said, in contradiction with what their ancestral and ancestors had fought for. Mm. You know, so in that sense, it really is lamentable that we have still got this kind of very shallow kind of understanding. Oh, chiefs and kings, what do they belong in a democracy? They don't,
Well, I mean, yeah, that's sort of where I come from, I suppose. Sometimes when I have these discussions or when I consider the role of traditional authorities, I do wonder what there's some kind of contradiction there, is there not, between a democracy and a traditional authority?
Not necessarily. I mean, this is what's been so... I was coming from exactly the same point of view. This is an anachronism from the 19th century to have chiefs and kings. But then I discovered that it wasn't... that the Constitution in Chapter 12 does entrench the role of... and they say traditional leadership system and customary law. And in the same way as that in the Bill of Rights, the rights don't belong to the state, they belong to people, customary law belongs to the people. And the Amampondo specifically, and I can't speak with any great expertise on other traditional communities, but I can certainly say from having researched it for my book, going back to King Faku in the 1820s and how he came to become king and how... through the whole annexation in 1894.
Is that after the frontier wars?
Yes, and that there was, and that the Amampondo actually have a very deep, robust form of democracy. And it's a participatory type of democracy. It's not a representative democracy.
I've been reading Tim Baker's book, actually, yes. The Land is Ours, and he does refer a lot to that,
yes,
to the, at the beginning, about the frontier wars, and also just that tradition of consultation.
Exactly.
Etc.
And it's based, this is what I find the curious sort of like another kind of synchronicity is that as I researched Ponder customary law, it's very much based on the principle of subsidiarity. And the subsidiarity principle
what
says...
What is that subsidiarity?
Subsidiarity means all decisions at a higher level of a hierarchy should be subsidiary to the decisions at the lower level. And that all decision-making should be devolved down to the lowest possible form, from down to the family, to the individual, and so that a high level... So it's basically, I suppose you could call it servant leadership, where a person that rises in the hierarchy do so in order to basically support and empower people to be most close. And from an environmental governance point of view, this is now seen as very important, because... Who sees the impact of environmental decisions? People on the ground, the earth, So that's why the Amampondo functioned according to that subsidiarity principle. They never used that word. And I had a discovery that in Catholic social teaching, the popes have even sent encyclicals and talking about subsidiarity as being the only way of actually properly, morally governing any situation. So they have it, even though people would say they're very good at preaching it, but not very good at practicing it, because we are very much a descending hierarchy. Although Archbishop Turley, when he was a marvelous bishop, because he always said to me, John, us bishops can preach and teach and priests can preach. You as a laity are the ones that must practice. It's all about what you do. It's all about, to use another theologic word, an incarnational approach to what we understand to be church and religion and faith. It's not about creeds and an intellectual assent to kind of dogmatic kind of things. I'm not particularly interested in that, even though I have a degree in theology. But I'm more interested in how reality is our far greater lessons learned from that. And how power also has unfortunately corrupted religious institutions. You're not immune to it either, so I'm not sitting here in any pious criticism.
I just want to try and consider the possibility that there are actually people in Golobeni or in that district that would like a mine. There.
Yes.
And how do you... I mean, how is that...
Well, in my involvement, I've always said I'm not an anti-mining activist. I'm a pro-human rights social worker, and I will talk to anybody. And building levels of trust, I even... you know, at one point was asked to come and talk to the directors of Zolco, the BEE partnership, and they invited me. And my approach to them was, look, folk, just, you know, I'm not, you make a choice. If you want that, go for it. But just go and get a second opinion, because the deal that's been offered to you folk is actually, I believe, a swindle. You know, and don't take my word for it. And a while later, one of them kind of, you know, is now on record in an interview on my YouTube channel, you know, one of the local school principals, who said they did go and talk to another lawyer, and they found that I was exactly right. Now, the pro-mining was, oh, this guy's been talking to John Clark. Nonsense. And I'm not an anti-mining activist. In fact, I'd be a hypocrite if I were, because as I sit here, you know, platinum is very close to my heart. I have a stent which keeps me alive. And after my second Amadiba adventure in 2002, I had a heart attack while I was on one of my wild coast things. Fortunately, it was just a angina attack, but then I had another one later. And unfortunately, my wife is a nurse. She saw it was happening. Off I was to Mill Park, and I had a stent inserted in into my left ventricle, which keeps me alive. So I say platinum is close to my heart, but it breaks my heart to see how rural communities have had to see their lands and their livelihoods dumped upon to extract that tiny piece of platinum, which keeps me alive in my relative privilege. But same time, using that little bit of mineral to say, well, how can we ensure that a mining regime takes root in this country, which does do what the MPRDA espouses of seeking the common good, rather than the investor interests of venture capitalists who are basically speculating.
Extractive both of mineral and of income,
yeah.
I suppose.
So I'm not, you know, and the irony of it is that there are people, you know, I suppose being a social worker, I believe most people are actually altruistic and well-motivated, even though they might occupy roles which force them into compromised positions. So when I introduce myself as a social worker and I tell them confidentially that what they say to me I can keep in confidence, well, then I'm suddenly the receptacle of all sorts of whistleblowing from people in the mining industry who are now giving me all the information I need to actually make my case. So you can understand why Mark Caruso is trying to kind of shut me up, because I've now got a vast amount of understanding from within the mining industry. Some of his former colleagues who are now, you know, on first-name terms, you know, we meet when we can and we talk about what's happening, because they were also feeling that they also were led under false pretenses. But my point getting to answer your question, if people are pro-mining, two things I want to say is that, look, folks, understand this thing. You know, Upton Sinclair's famous quote, which Al Gore, you know, popularized. It's very hard for people to understand something when their paycheck depends on them not understanding it. Now, I'm not saying he says it's hard. It's not impossible. So my role as a social worker said, well, okay, I know this is in your material interest to go for this mining, but just consider this. And this brings me to the second point I say, and I'm still waiting. I say to the Department of Resources, to Mark Caruso, to anybody out there, I hope your vast listenership will kind of help me with this question. Well, and this is a question. Show me.
I like to call them small but influential.
The question is simple and influential. And these are people who think, because I can see from your previous podcast, you really don't, you know, you really have people who are thoughtful. Show me where in the world a rural community that's been relocated from their ancestral lands as an equivalence to what will happen at Qulabeni, who have collectively, after the mining
re-establishment,
have had a better quality of life as a consequence of that mining. Now, I have friends who are professors at Wits University in the geology department who go to international conferences. I've asked them to ask him there. So internationally, I've got networks. I have yet to find a single solitary instance where it has been in the collective common good of people. Now, so now we're talking about 100 families in the Wild Coast community who will be resettled. They are the ones that are giving up their land. So Greta Montashe talking about surveys and all the rest, they've already exercised it. 68 out of the 74 or so of them have already, you know, kind of given Richard Spoor had their mandate. They have, and I've been at those meetings over the years, filming them, where it's repeatedly saying, we do not want mining. I mean, I have one funny incident where the mining guy from MRC came back and he told them, and old Bala Shaleni very politely said to Andrew Lashbrook, now look, please, you know, you're welcome to come back here, but come with another proposal, please, not a mining one. If you come with a tourism proposal, we'll consider it. You know, Andrew sort of shook his head, but we're a mining company. So he said, well, why did you think out the box and come back with something? So the point is that I've seen that there is a very deep thing. So, and I mean, it shouldn't, if it's there, it shouldn't be too hard then to help people to realize that this is how it will happen. And this can be beneficial to you. And it's particularly, in this particular instance, and let's not lose sight of this one, Nick, they had a pre-existing economic activity. Their ecotourism was thriving. I mean, that was why it was doing one of the... It was amazing.
Has that all ended now?
It hasn't. We've managed to revive it. We've kind of busy trying to kind of promote tourism, agricultural base, driven by the people, as the RDP originally enshrined. But... the tragedy is, and this is for me when I start really thinking about it, I can't, you know, disagree with this conscientious idea that says the sabotage of that ecotourism initiative, Amadibra Adventures, represented an economic crime against that community.
Hmm. And that's, it was sabotage?
It was sabotage, and I have evidence to show... Oops. I have evidence that is indicative of that. And there needs to be a commission of inquiry, I believe, just for that. And we would actually do... Because the interesting thing is that the Kolobeni story is prefigured, the whole state capture story. You know, we see, you know, very much the same
tentacles
kind of...
And, you know, the... The processes.
Exactly. So in that sense, I have, and I think it's appropriate to say now that Sam's published the story, that same evidence that he worked with has been submitted to the Zondo Commission, and we have made our case, and we're saying you need to consider this, both from the point of view of substantively indicating state capture, but also showing the consequences of what happens to a rural community when the state is captured because they are unable to access the institutions for the rule of law. Their criminal behavior gets kind of unprosecuted. People don't get arrested as they should be. I mean, it's 3.5 years, and Bazooka is still, his killers are still roaming free. There have been other violence that's happened in the community before Bazooka was killed, where there have been arrests, but it's been for 3.5 years that they keep postponing that court case. And it's a travesty of justice to think that it's not just justice delayed, it's justice denied. It's injustice compounded. Anyway, I need to calm down and say, but hang on, John, there is an opportunity here. There is actually, even though I kind of when I park it and look, a good news story actually here, because it's showing what is possible where, you know, in South Africa today. You know, we don't have to simply wring our hands in despair. And I was sharing this with some friends down at in the Kruger Park just last week. I was down there because there's now another proposal to mine coal on the borders of Kruger Park. So I went and gave them a solidarity message of support, and I said to them, and of course the complexion of that group was completely different to the complexion of the Amadiba. But actually, I was able to say, folk, you know, you're going to win your case, provided that you make sure that it's in the interest of the most vulnerable and disadvantaged as well, not just your own privilege, that you actually have solid facts at your disposal, and then you have a good lawyer, and that the media, because, I mean, we would never have been able to achieve if it wasn't, you know, what has happened in the Wild Coast, were it not for the likes of, you know, Nicholas Claude and Kevin Bloom and all the others.
Sam.
Although I need to hasten to say, if I would say, I don't, first thing I always say to a journalist who I meet him, I said, listen, please be as hard on me as you are on the other side. I don't want you to be anyway seen to be captured by John Clark. I have my own narrative. I am subject to confirmation bias just as everybody else. I'm only ever as good to my clients as a social worker if, to the extent to which I'm seeing the full reality, not just what I'm selectively wanting to see. And I mean, the irony is Mark Caruso tells me I'm terribly ignorant. John, you're so naive and all the rest. I mean, all I've been trying to say, Mark, I'm trying to widen your spectrum of understanding of what's happening here. Mm. And because I am subject to that. And of course, because I believe ultimately the truth will set you free, even though it will piss you off at the beginning.
You don't want to get too high on your own.
Exactly, yeah. And yeah. I mean, exactly. And that's why, I mean, fortunately, I've got my wife and children who keep me humble. And I say that in the best way possible because they do really. And I have a sort of a sense in which they kind of help me see my blind spots. We all have our blind spots. They don't show up as dark patches. We're not aware that we have them. We need to have a loving confrontation about it. I have tried to do that even with my adversaries, the likes of, you know, with Guido Montash and Mark Caruso and even Sandile Nonkina. But, you know, there comes a point where, you know, people have had to say to me, John, hang on, they're not your clients. You can love your enemies, but remember, they remain your enemies. Mm. You're not going to just be careful about being co-opted by them into a little dance with the devil. Just be true to who you are, true to yourself, and don't try and so much defend your truth as just live truthfully, openly, receptively, humbly, you know, and that's... But, of course, if you say, long last, I'm humble, that's the most prideful statement one can make. Yeah. But Kevin Bloom keeps me in check. He kind of checks me out. And in fact, all my journalist friends, we argue like crazy. Don't think this is a kind of like a sort of a getter of kind of a... Of consensus by any stretch.
John, let's end it there. Thanks a lot for your time, and all the best going forward with this struggle.
Thank you. Thanks, Nick, and it's been a great pleasure. You've helped me. You should be a social worker, quite honestly. you know how to listen.
Thanks again. Yeah, he's a pretty intense guy, no doubt, committed, has that faith of activism, I suppose the belief that change is going to come, change is possible, and he does allude to a chat I had with Ronnie Castrels, you know, you just got to sometimes keep on going and believe in the path, believe in the struggle. I suppose one can only hope that the dispute is resolved amicably, without any further death, certainly, and without any community evictions. Funnily enough, Sam Sol, who I also, journalist Sam Sol, I'm a Bongani, who I had on the show recently, wrote an article just the other day, July the 1st. It's published on the Daily Maverick, looking at the history of the Golobeni dispute and the role of state actors as well in that, so please have a look for that. It's a pretty comprehensive read. John, at the same time, has written a book called The Promise of Justice. It's about the struggles of Mpondo King Kau against colonial and capitalist forces in the Eastern Cape, I suppose, to provide some context to the current dispute in Golobeni. Voices from SA is hosted on Audio Boom. You may also subscribe to Voices from SA via Apple Podcasts, where you can leave a comment or a review, which I would appreciate. You can also find Voices from SA on Spotify, Radio Public, Deezer, or indeed wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your colleagues, tell your friends, tell the world. Until next time, I'm Nicholas Claude. Cheers.